The information in today's episode is not to be used as medical advice. If you are currently struggling with or dealing with something out of the ordinary, we highly recommend talking directly to your provider. Welcome to the Flow State Podcast, where we're all about finding balance. We're your hosts, Monica Groney
and Nora Candido. Now let's get into the flow.
Welcome back, Flow State listeners. We have a great episode lined up today. It's something I've been paying more attention to, and I think you're going to learn a lot. So really excited to dive into blood sugar regulation, how blood sugar affects our hormones, what role it plays, things we can look out for in terms of noticing blood sugar imbalances, all of that. Nora is bringing the heat today.
Yeah, I think this topic is definitely much more on the rise. I know like Organic Olivia has been talking a lot about blood sugar balance. Some people are starting to wear the continuous glucose monitors. I'll talk a little bit about that today too. I just ran a program. It was like a 3-week program where people wore a monitor for 2 weeks, track their diet, track their blood sugar results to make actionable changes and really figure out what the best foods are for their body. And I think that's going to be a huge takeaway is that a lot of this stuff is, like all parts of nutrition, super individualized, where like foods in my body are going to react differently than foods even in your body, which I think is really, really important.
Yeah, definitely. I think we can a lot of times get caught up in the things that are said on social media or that we hear, and we're like, oh, I can't eat that anymore because it's going to affect my blood sugar. But it's like, will it affect your blood sugar? Or does it affect the person who was talking about it? So before we go too deep, let's just actually talk about what is blood sugar.
Yeah. So the whole way that we're able to survive and exist is our body is able to take food and turn it into sugar molecules called glucose. And so when we're monitoring blood sugar, we're actually monitoring those levels of glucose in our body. So every food that we eat, our body is finding ways to repackage it, turn it into those sugar molecules or glucose molecules. And that is how we are able to get energy from our food. So the co-pilot in this is insulin. And how I like to describe insulin, and this is like a very well-known metaphor, on our cells, every single cell, especially like our muscle cells, we have these receptor sites, and insulin is said to be the key that allows glucose to enter into the cell. So as soon as we start eating, that insulin is spit out by our pancreas, and it's circulating around, and it is allowing that sugar to go into our cells for energy in the most simplest terms. So people like with type 1 diabetes, they actually do not produce insulin. So that's why they might be on a pump where they're getting insulin from an outside source to allow their body to do this natural job. Whereas type 2 diabetes specifically, that insulin may still be produced or it may be lessened, but the actual cells themselves are desensitized to the insulin. So that can cause more circulating blood sugar in our body because we don't have enough of those keys to let the sugar into the cells and to work.
Wow. Okay. You just explained it in a way where it's like clicking for me. I was telling Nora before, I'm like, I might have some questions because insulin always confuses me, but that makes a lot of sense. So glucose is the sugar. Insulin is the key that lets the glucose into our cells.
Exactly.
Amazing. And I think we hear this topic a lot around, especially in the menstrual space, around people with PCOS. So what is that relationship?
Exactly. Yeah. So for many different reasons, we can have that insulin sensitivity changes or what's referred to as insulin resistance. So again, that's where the cells are just not sensitized. They're not responding the way that they normally should to that key allowing the sugar into the cell. And that's a really common driver in PCOS or polycystic ovarian syndrome, where this can show up as weight changes. It can show up as inflammation just in the body and that too relates to weight changes. It can throw off other organ systems in our body, like our thyroid, all of these things, but it can also impact your mood, how you're thinking. Like if your body is not able to use energy efficiently, then of course, like you're not going to be thinking the same or performing the same, especially any type of physical activity or again, with the weight changes. So that's a really big connection. And one of the first things, just to kind of briefly talk about like ways that we monitor blood sugar, there is a few different ways. So we can check your fasting blood sugar, which is just like a point in time where you might get either a finger prick or if you're getting a blood draw, they would check your blood sugar at that very, very moment.
Hey there, it's your host, Nora, your dietitian. Many of you have been reaching out to me to find out the best way to come off of hormonal birth control. I'm super excited. My group program called Harmonize that I created just for this reason, based off my own personal story, is now reopened. We're changing things up this year where you can join at any point. Our meetings are weekly, where you have tailored tips to help your body go through this transition, education, guest coaches, as well as a community to support you through it. Head over to the show notes to find the link to apply today.
Then there's this cumulative 90-day average that's called a hemoglobin A1C marker. And that is what gives us the best indication of where things are at the majority of the time. And the way that our body, I just think it's so fascinating that we're able to get this like cumulative average over a period of time without having to measure it every single day. And that's, you know, for individuals that might be at risk for prediabetes or assessing for PCOS or other health conditions, that is the lifespan of our red blood cells, is about 90 or so days. And they're measuring the percentage of the sugar molecule that's attached to that red blood cell. So the hemoglobin A1C is actually a percentage of the glucose attached to the red blood cell over the course of 90 days. So that's how we can get that number. And then there's other markers we can check for fasted insulin or just insulin in general. And that gives us a really good indication because you can have blood sugar saying one thing, but insulin saying something differently. And that also helps to give us different pieces of the puzzle and help to support your body. And okay, it's not really a blood sugar quote problem, it's an insulin problem, or vice versa. And different strategies around that. But yeah, PCOS is a really big one. And also with menopause. So as we're going through this kind of reverse puberty, I like to call it, or the transition into menopause, our sensitivity to insulin changes because of the change in hormones, especially more related to estrogen. And what most menopausal individuals experience is this like tire around their waist of fat. And that is a huge marker of insulin resistance or changes to that insulin response in your body. So if that's you, you know, knowing something that we can actually change, it's not a life sentence. And there are so many things you can do to support that even through menopause, to me is really, really exciting.
Yeah, we're going to get into that, right? Like some of the things people can do if they are noticing some of these signs or symptoms.
Absolutely. And even now they're actually calling Alzheimer's like type 3 diabetes, where when, again, if you have elevated blood sugar for extended periods of time, that's inflammation in your brain, it can cause a lot of these what are called neurodegenerative disorders or things like Alzheimer's. And so the stuff that we're talking about today, this is not for like, oh, that's a future problem. The better grasp you have on it now, even if you're 18 years old, if you're 25, you're like, no matter what your age is going to improve your health outcomes for the foreseeable future. And that is powerful stuff. Like, what if you could age slower? What if you could conserve the quality of your life, prevent a lot of these diseases? That is what you have the power of doing in every single choice that you're making when it comes to food.
Yeah. And longevity is just like so powerful, right? We all want to live an energetic, long life as long as possible. And I don't know, aging, it can be terrifying. So if we can do things to prevent or slow that process, I think that why wouldn't we?
yeah, really actionable. Like, that's the goal of today. Make this as simple as possible so that there are things you can walk away listening to this episode that you can make simple swaps. You don't have to overhaul your diet. You don't have to change a ridiculous amount of things. Learning how to support this is what we're going to cover today.
Yeah. And so I know that muscle plays a role in all of this. And, you know, I've become quite the muscle queen. But can you maybe just talk to that a little bit? And I think especially talking about Alzheimer's, and there's been like a lot of newness coming out around the importance of skeletal muscle to support Alzheimer's. And so I'm, yeah, curious to kind of hear about that.
Yeah, exercise is a huge component of helping with that metabolic health. And anytime you hear that term metabolic health, a lot of that has to do with the markers we're talking about today. And so when we're exercising, our body has to utilize incoming energy. So say we have just eaten something and now we're going to go move our body. It is going to use up that energy that we just consumed. So that's why, you know, having something before a workout is better for you as a fertile female, because that's going to give your body this readily available carbohydrate rich punch to just fuel your workout. When you're exercising, your body, if it burns through that fuel, or if you haven't eaten, then it's going to be breaking down other parts of our body, our muscle and our fat. It actually does those equally. It doesn't like prefer fat over muscle. So when you lose weight, you're losing both, just as an FYI. But it breaks down those pieces and uses stored energy, the stored glucose molecules, and turns that into usable energy to fuel your workout. So you can actually experience an increase in your blood sugar when you're exercising. And that's because your body's like, okay, I need a lot of energy right now to complete this workout. But exercise itself helps to resensitize those cells and make them more receptive or sensitive to insulin. So that's why it's so important, and how it can really help improve your metabolic health is because it's helping those cells to stay alert, and it makes them what are called metabolically flexible, so that you can be able to switch back and forth, even using this like new incoming energy or the stored energy, and doing that efficiently.
Yeah, really interesting. When we say like exercise, are we talking about a specific type of exercise, or is it just the increase actually in kind of heart rate?
The latter, yeah. Any type of exercise, and you know, different types of exercise and the duration are all going to have different impacts on your body's usage of that energy, but they are still all going to improve just the overall health of those cells and the ability to be sensitive again to insulin.
Awesome. Okay, so how does this all tie in then? Obviously, we are very hormone related here on the podcast. So what role does blood sugar play in terms of our hormones, our cycles, all of that?
Yeah. So a big boils down to a lot of like this inflammation piece. So any high or any low, even, it's not better to have really low blood sugar. It's actually also a warning sign to our body, like something, we're in this like starvation mode.
Yeah. I mean, everyone out there has heard of hanger, I think.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
That is a low blood sugar situation.
Yeah. We'll dive into those symptoms in a second. But, you know, anytime we're experiencing that high or that low, that is a form of stress on our body, and that can be a driver of inflammation. So both the stress piece and the inflammation piece can directly impact our hormone status. We've talked a lot on here about even ovulation health. And if you're stressed, your body might not be ovulating appropriately. Like, all of it boils down. So this is really the first place that I start with everybody that I work with, because we're never really taught how to eat. We're not taught how to balance our plate. We're not taught how to incorporate all foods. You know, in my eyes, like, all foods fit. And if you want to enjoy a sweet, like, here's how to do it so that it's not going to mess up your mood or your energy or your blood sugar, or put you into one of these kind of hormonal tizzies, so to speak.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, stress is such a crucial thing when we talk about hormone balance and reproductive health. And so just, yeah, you know, blood sugar puts that stress on the body, and it's a no bueno situation.
Yeah, exactly. Have you experienced like a low blood sugar event, or have you noticed a high blood sugar event? Like, what does that feel like in your body?
Yeah, I am someone who often experiences low blood sugar events because I get very focused on things and can forget to eat. Like, I will accidentally skip meals because I'll get so zoned into something. And, you know, dizziness is a big one for me, for sure. Realizing that I'm just like faint, like shaky, anxious. Although I wouldn't say concentration is a huge issue because I'm like so concentrated in those moments. But, you know, just coming up for air in a moment of realizing I haven't had a meal in like 5 or 6 hours, I'll be like, oh my God, I'm all of a sudden so hungry. I get headaches, like we'll go into just kind of a spiral of I could probably just go to sleep at that point. But I'm trying to get better at that because I know for sure that those instances are making my mood symptoms a lot worse in the long haul. So I am trying to eat more regularly.
Love that. Yeah. No, you ticked like a lot of the symptoms off that are really common. And I think a challenging piece is that you can have a lot of similar symptoms for high blood sugar as well as low blood sugar. So getting to learn again, like these steps, and that's why I do really like using the continuous glucose monitor for a lot of people. They're very motivated by data and it's helpful just to see what's going on. You're like, I feel really off. Okay, this makes sense. I'm having a low or I'm having a high. And again, for non-diabetic individuals, just being able to see that I think is really helpful. But yeah, you know, the dizziness, shakiness, sweating, having to go to the bathroom more, fainting or feeling faint, feeling like extreme hunger, and that for a lot of people, they might not feel that in their stomach. It can be that loss of concentration, or if you're like, I don't even know why I can't focus anymore. Like I've run out of gas. It makes a lot of sense. And in some extreme situations, it can even put people into a coma and can even cause death. Like it's definitely not, you know, that's probably going to be more common in the individuals that have something like type 1 diabetes or type 2 diabetes, not for the most, I would say in the most cases, the average person. But, you know, it's not something to mess around with. And it's something that we can all, again, make these like simple habit swaps to support it.
Yeah, for me, it's not even always like a blood sugar spike. We talked about how it can be related to exercise. Obviously, it's related to eating. But I'll even notice some of these symptoms. And I have heard that this is also a blood sugar spike of in a situation where I'm nervous or, you know, like almost embarrassed or something like catches you off guard. Those situations, like public speaking, I can get the symptoms of a blood sugar spike. And I've heard that, you know, your blood sugar can spike from those emotional instances too.
Yeah, it's stress. And our body can't tell the difference of if you were running from a bear, you would want that increase in blood sugar because you're literally trying to run for your survival. It can't tell the difference between those events or you public speaking or taking off on a flight or whatever. I like witnessed somebody almost get hit by a car yesterday and my heart just like absolutely sunk. And I was so, so freaked out. It didn't even happen to me.
Yeah. Even like walking down the street and you trip and then you have to like catch yourself. I'll notice my body be like, and like, I get this full flush and it's like a blood sugar rush.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, it can happen that quickly again, because if we needed to, that's how much things are going on in the background too, which I feel fascinated by that, but it's so wild and amazing.
Yeah. What other things can impact our blood sugar?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we talked like, obviously the food that you're eating, your sleep can impact your exercise. So even exercise, we talked about how it's helpful to, in the long run, like keep that metabolic health, but actual exercise itself, how that can change your blood sugar response in both directions too. So some people, if they haven't had enough, they're under fueling or they don't have enough of that storage form of carbohydrates, it's called glycogen.
then they can actually experience a low event while they're exercising. Or that's why, you know, when you're on endurance runs or doing long-term activity, you need to be fueling after about 60 or so minutes, depending on your sport and intensity. And that's because your body's burning up this fuel. We need to replenish it.
Yeah, that's bonking. I mean, that's what we call it anyways. Like long runs or time in the mountains, skiing, anything like that. Like if you bonk, it's not a fun experience. You're just all of a sudden like dragging ass.
Yeah, that makes sense. You've run out of gas. Hydration can also impact it, which leads to caffeine consumption can also impact it. I can talk a little bit on that. And then even some medications, especially like steroids or some like psych meds, can actually impact our blood sugar as well. So that's a really important piece. Like if you've noticed some weight change, especially being on one of those, it can be related more to blood sugar control. With the caffeine, because I think this is always pretty fascinating, you know, our body is burning up fuel. And when the caffeine kind of wears off, which is about 6 or so hours for most individuals, then you're crashing and your body's either saying, I need more caffeine or I need some carbs. And that's because it's like, I've run out of gas, I need more energy. And when you get into that like extreme hunger, hanger mode, you're not going to be like, I would like a salad right now. Your body's like, give me sugar right now. Otherwise, I'm going to pass out. And that's, there's a internal drive for that because it's the quickest form of energy. Like you may have heard some diabetics carry around like glucose tabs, which is literally just sugar. Or if they need to drink a soda or have some juice or even milk, it's the quickest way for our body to take that liquid sugar and turn it into usable energy so that you don't faint.
Yeah, I remember my brother was like that as a kid, you know, and maybe he wasn't eating often enough, but my mom definitely always carried around crackers for him just because he would like hit a glycemic like, ah, and like be crashing and really, really need food.
Yeah. And that's where like being proactive. So diving in, like my most basic suggestions are not skipping meals, obviously. Like if you're functioning, even if you were to lay in bed all day, your body is still burning through, for majority of people, over 1,000 calories. Like some people put themselves on very, very low restrictive diets, and that's not even enough to sustain like your heart pumping and your brain thinking and your breath breathing. All of those functions take energy. So you don't need to rationalize, oh, I deserve to eat. You need to eat in order to live, in order to be here. You need fuel. So not skipping meals is super important, obviously.
Yeah, for sure. And it even like, I think that in the weight loss space, you know, it's talked about a lot, especially like the science is to have a calorie deficit, right? You know, when people are training or looking to change their body type, calorie deficit is the big word. But at the end of the day, like the calorie deficit that you need to make a change in your body when you're exercising, when you are strength training, when you are like doing any form of exercise, the deficit's really, really small. And sometimes it's not even every day of the week. It's like on average, and it's honestly like maybe 200 calories, which 200 calories is like one bar or something. So I think people hear calorie deficit and they go from like eating a caloric diet of, you know, 2000 calories all the way down to 1400 calories. And like, that's like danger zone, not necessary. So just thought I'd throw that in there.
Yeah. And in my experience in working with athletes, they're already coming to me eating very low amounts. And most commonly, we actually have to feed up first. Getting your body back into that safe zone, that's going to help support the stress response, that cortisol, and then eventually entering into something like a deficit. And a deficit doesn't need to just come from food. It can be a change in your energy expenditure. So moving your body more, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to cut out all of these foods. But I think those are exceptional points, you know, partially related to blood sugar, but a really, really important piece here.
Yeah, food is our friend and we need that energy for not just, you know, being more active, but also for our brains and for, like you said, our heart, like everything. We just need the energy. So don't skip meals. And I'm saying it to myself because I'm the worst, but.
And if I can offer just something really small, if you are not in tune to your body's hunger and fullness cues, which is something that I see so often, and this could be due to diet culture or trying to convince yourself you're not hungry so long so that your body is like, well, I'm not even going to send these signals anymore until I'm at like extreme levels. Maybe you need an external reminder. Maybe you need a little calendar ping that goes off on your computer. If you're deep in your work, something that's going to be like, hey, you can't miss this. Wake up, eat something. Even if you're not hungry, it's been 4 hours. Like, you need to eat something. And that's going to prevent you from going into that low, which is going to prevent the stress. It's going to give you sustained energy, focus, etc. And if you're just going to feel so much better. Like, I have people that feel hungover on a consistent basis without even drinking. And it's because their blood sugar is like a roller coaster all day long. It's like, I have a granola bar that's super sweet and you have this huge spike and then you come crashing down and your body's like, hey, I need sugar again. So they reach for the sugar and that gives them maybe another hour's worth of energy and you're in the same exact boat again. You're going to feel like shit. Absolute shit. And that's not a way to live. That's not quality of life. That's not sustainable. If you, like, I know when you started incorporating more protein into your diet, the biggest thing that you shared with me that stuck out was having less cravings. And it makes so much sense. It takes hours for protein to digest. So you're going to have more sustained energy than just having carbohydrates. And I think that really leads into my kind of first step of actionable things we could be doing to prevent blood sugar spikes and crashes.
Yeah. Tell us about, I mean, I think you just talked about too, you talked about someone reaching for a granola bar and that's heavy in sugar. And so it spikes versus like me eating more protein, satiation is more, you know, it takes longer to digest. What does a balanced meal look like? Or is there an order we should eat our foods in? Or like, let's go. I want to hear it.
All of the above. So yeah, I started wearing a continuous glucose monitor almost a year ago. And it's because at my snack time, I was eating a Go Macro bar. And like the second ingredient is brown rice syrup, aka sugar. So I was feeling this like huge spike of energy. And then within an hour of eating that bar, I felt like garbage. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm hypoglycemic. And I was doing it so often. And I wanted to see, and was I actually low or was I just experiencing this really dramatic downswing after having a huge spike? And that was the case, but I wanted to see like what was going on. My body was just burning up that energy so quickly. But if you're on a mountain, if you're in a race, if you are, you need that quick energy hit, not when you're sitting at your desk. Like, we don't need a Cliff bar sitting at our desk. It's not what it's made for. It's literally made for climbing freaking mountains. You need that energy for a different time.
I think that's a great call out too, is that like our fueling for exercise. So like if you're an athlete, meaning you exercise basically, how you fuel for pre-exercise, during exercise is like different than what we're immediately talking about right now. We're talking about like every day you're at the office, how do you eat, as opposed to like you're saying, like the Cliff bar, that's literally for a 5 hour hike, not 5 hours, but you know what I mean? Like a day out in the mountains. So
exactly. When you need that like readily available energy, it has that easy to digest sugar. And that's what they built them for, that reason, but not for just like a palatable snack, which they're delicious. Like I, of course, but it was really insightful. Okay. So yeah, my whole premise of like, we're never really taught how to eat. Now they thankfully have changed some things. It's called My Plate. And now the My Plate is much more helpful because it's actionable, where it shows at each meal, we should be having a quality source of protein, quality source of fat, and carbohydrates. And I even alter that a little bit to make sure that it contains fiber. So I say protein, fat, and fiber, knowing that fiber, which comes from most vegetables, some nuts, that is also a source of carbohydrate, more so when it's coming from the veggies and fruits. But yeah, I refine that to say proteins, fats, and fibers. When we talk about meal composition, that's that balanced plate and being able to identify each of those at every single meal. If you're having a snack, it needs to have protein, fat, and fiber. Like, just get into the habit of being able to identify those things. And, you know, those are resources that I provide all of my clients to even know, like, well, what is a protein? Because a lot of people don't know. What is a fat? You might think that protein is coming from peanuts when that's really more of a source of fat. You know, like, we're not really taught these things. And that's where working with someone like a dietitian or just getting more educated about foods in general can be really helpful for your system.
And when we talk about that, okay, protein, fats, and fiber, is that the order we should eat them in? Or what is, you know, and I guess, like, why is there an order that we should eat them in?
Yeah. So the order that we should be eating them in is actually the fiber first, protein, and then the fat. And that has to do with a variety of reasons. So the fiber from vegetables especially, so having like a green starter of some sort, really easy to do that, or even having like a pickle, or if you're, you know, it's lunchtime and you need something quick, you're not going to have a salad appetizer and a salad main meal. Having that fiber first, it helps to create like almost like a mesh in your stomach that makes the following contents digest slower. So picturing like if you have a funnel and then you have a little mesh lining in there, it's going to help just slow down the way that things are being digested so it's not happening too quickly. That fiber is also not completely digested by our body, so it doesn't turn into that quick energy or that glucose spike. Even though it's coming from carbohydrates, that fiber does not have the same response because our body can't break it down. And that's what's so helpful for a million reasons, especially like bulking up our stool, helping to flush out a lot of cholesterol and excess hormones and things in our body, is that fiber component. So by making sure that you're having a source of fiber at each meal is going to be so helpful for not only just this metabolic health that we're talking about today, but also your hormone health, big time. It's going to help your bowel health. It's going to help your heart health. All of these things just by starting to incorporate. I forget the percentage, to be honest, but like I think it's less than 10% of Americans are actually getting the amount of fiber that we need on a daily basis. So for women, it should be 25 grams per day of fiber. For men, it should be 38 grams per day of fiber. And then those numbers actually go down a little bit after age, or I think it's around 50. For both men and women, it's a little bit lower in both cases, but you're likely not eating too much fiber.
Yeah. And I mean, like, is there harm in overeating fiber?
Not especially. I mean, some people might then go on the other direction where if you experience GI issues or you have, you know, you could get maybe a little bit more backed up. Again, if your body is like, you need to have a lot of water and things to help flush that out too.
Awesome. Okay. So fiber first.
Fiber first. Then our proteins. Then our fat, and then any starchy carbs. So when I even say starchy carbs, that includes some starchy vegetables like potatoes, like carrots, like beets. Those foods are, again, they quickly turn to sugar in our body. And none of that is, quote, bad. Like, we need them. I don't want anyone to leave here and say, you know, there's been such a huge fad for I don't even know how long of eating low carb. And if you don't understand that all vegetables are carbohydrates. Like, we need vegetables in our diet.
Yeah, totally. I think I demonized carbs for a while and now I'm just like full embrace. So
our bodies need at least 120 grams of carbs per day just for our brains to function. And I'm sure people are going to say, you know, I do keto. It's great. I feel awesome. I don't want to invalidate that here. I just want to take a moment to acknowledge ketones, if you've looked into this at all, is our body's ability to use fat for energy. So where we talked about that glucose being used, it is still our preferred and our primary source of energy, but our body has the survival mechanism to be able to use fat for energy as well for survival. So that's what people are doing when they're saying they're going keto. That's the way that it works. I'm not going to dive into that any further today, but I know somebody would be like, well, Nora, you're wrong because I can survive without XYZ.
Yeah.
but the average person should not.
But even in the keto diet, like they eat vegetables, so whatever.
Yes, exactly. And those are like the lower non-starchy vegetables, a lot of cruciferous veggies. You can even have berries. You know, there are ways to do it in a more healthful manner, but it is not my recommended mode of eating or style of eating for any fertile person, unless you have to. I mean, it was literally designed to treat pediatric epilepsy or seizures. So, you know, caveat there. I just want to also say that.
In the order of eating, you talked about, so we're doing starchy carbs last. What is the no naked carbs kind of, you know, way of thinking? Why do we not want to eat these starchy carbs on their own?
Yeah. So again, it's just that like quick energy, and we're going to experience a spike and then we're going to experience a crash. So I give this as an example, especially when it comes to snacking. I see this more often where people be like, oh, well, I had a piece of fruit. Like, that's good, right? And in my world, there's no good or bad. There's no healthy or unhealthy. But there are ways that you can make that energy last so much longer. So if you were previously eating an apple, that might satisfy you or give you energy for about an hour, and then you're hungry again. If you eat half of that apple but add 2 tablespoons of a nut butter, you're now incorporating that protein, fat, and fiber, and you're going to go from having maybe an hour's worth of energy to having multiple hours worth of energy. And that's great. Like, that's the ideal. It's going to make your body feel so much better in so many means. We don't need to focus on like the lower calorie or the less amount of food. It's going to benefit you in the long run for sure.
Yeah, it just makes sense. I mean, the energy, and it feels better. It feels good. So yeah, love that.
At each meal, this is kind of like an initial gut check that if you've eaten something and then you're hungry within an hour or 2 hours or so, you know that that last meal either wasn't balanced enough or you didn't eat enough. Like, our meals should last us at least 3 to 4 hours worth of energy per eating time. So that's just like a really quick thing you can do to say, okay, maybe breakfast today wasn't the best fit and I can try again tomorrow, but I'm going to eat now because I'm hungry.
Yeah.
You know, not saying like, well, it's only 11. I can't eat until it's noon. Like, nope. Nothing's wrong. You're not going to break. Like, if your body's telling you that you're hungry and it's been 3-4 hours, you know, I especially see this in the morning time. If you're having breakfast at 7 and you're not eating lunch until noon, yeah, it's a really long time. You're going to be hungry. You might need a snack.
Yeah. I feel at the most, like, I feel like if we go out to eat and we eat a carb heavier meal, so we go out to eat and we have like pizza, we go out to eat and I have a pasta dish, I'll definitely the next day, or even like going to bed later that night, be like, oh, I'm hungry again. And it's like, yeah, it just makes sense. You burn through that so much faster.
Exactly. And there's workarounds around that. Like, I love pizza. What if you had a salad to start getting that fiber in? Maybe you throw some chicken on that salad or some shrimp or some tofu or whatever your heart desires. And then you have your pizza. You're likely not going to eat as much pizza, which is fine. And you're still going to get to enjoy that food, and you're not going to have the blood sugar crash, spike, roller coaster. Like, you can still do all of these things. You can go out to eat. Maybe not having the fresh, yummy, warm bread basket when it first comes out, saving that, right, to have at the end of your meal, or at least having some of that fiber first. Like, order some olives, order some whatever, green.
Have it with your salad first. Yeah.
I mean, ideally, again, we actually want to save it for last. That would be the goal.
The bread, right, right.
Right, but having something green first is really going to help to just slow down the rest of what we're eating and help with that blood sugar balance.
Makes sense. Just makes sense. And the same goes like for having dessert, like we just talked about. Like, yes, have the pizza. Yes, have the pasta. Yes, have the dessert. But it sounds like, if I'm learning correctly,
I was going to quiz you,
is to have the dessert last.
Exactly. And, you know, I think about this, especially around Thanksgiving, like my family will eat this big meal at 2 p.m. and then like 2 hours later, we'll have dessert. The best thing that we actually can do is have that dessert immediately after our meal. Because you have the composition of all these other foods sitting in your stomach, so that that sugar is going to hit completely different than if you were just to eat it in isolation or on its own a couple hours later. You know, yesterday afternoon, the sun was shining, 60 plus degrees. My friend and I just went for ice cream in the afternoon. Like, amazing. That's not my everyday. But still being able to acknowledge, like, you can do those things. But if you're consistently doing it, then that's the difference.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay, I know there are a couple of other quote unquote hacks for blood sugar balance. So what are those?
Yeah. Other ones that I just named here quickly is like having a savory breakfast is a really great way to start your day. Not having something sweet, which is the go-to in America, especially of cereal, toast, Pop-Tart, toaster strudel, all of the also delicious things. But again, if you've been listening, like that's going to give you that quick spike of energy and then you're going to come crashing down. And that can really, it's been shown to set you up for the remainder of the day. I had somebody who was like, my sleep was really off the night after I had a really bad, quote, blood sugar management day. And yeah, that can impact you. And also if you have poor quality sleep, then your blood sugar is going to be impacted the next day. You might notice like if you're hungover or if you've had a poor night's sleep, your body's likely craving more carbohydrates. And that's because of everything that we've been talking about today. It's lower energy, you might be dehydrated, all of the things. And our body is looking for more of that quick energy. Yeah, savory breakfast. And then walking after or around meals. So even walking before a meal can be great. Again, it's helping to like sensitize those cells. Walking immediately after a meal does not need to be a crazy long hour walk. You can literally walk for 10 minutes. Just getting your heart rate up, actually. So if you can't go outside, like doing some jumping jacks in your room, don't throw up. Do some push-ups, like something that's going to get your heart rate up is one, it's going to help with your digestion. And two, it's really going to help with helping that blood sugar control. That's a super easy one.
Yeah. I think it was a love-hate relationship with Tim Ferriss, but in the 5-Hour Body, he talks about how when he's at restaurants, he'll go into the bathroom and just do like 15 air squats in a stall real quick. And he's like, it's gotten awkward a few times, but.
Yeah. And again, like, what's the consistent thing, like the everyday versus those one-offs? You know, if all you're doing is traveling and eating out and whatnot, then like, okay. But that's where you could kind of toe into some disordered patterns. And that's something that I want to be mindful of as well. You know, when we start to create more and more of these rules and restrictions or limitations around what we're eating or how we're eating, being mindful of that. You know, I worked with a lot of individuals in disordered eating and eating disorder space, and not something to also play around with.
Yeah. I think this last one is something that we've talked about on a previous episode, maybe, but the apple cider vinegar before meals.
Yeah. So it has a couple of ways that it works. You can actually do any type of vinegar. It doesn't have to just be apple cider. I think most people think that it's the most tasty version, and you do you. But even that's where I was saying, like having the pickles, or if you're having a salad, like choosing to dress it with some vinegar and a little bit of oil, like that's the best thing that you can do for multiple reasons. With the ACV drink, you want to mix a tablespoon into a glass of water. So it's actually a pretty decent volume, and it's the acid itself that helps to stabilize the blood sugar. So I know, Monica, you like to implement this one when you know, like going out for that pasta or going out for the pizza. Sure. Like that's great. Having it 20 minutes before the meal is ideal. Even having it during or 20 minutes after is still going to have some benefits, but that's a pretty easy. I have like a soda stream at home, so I make sparkling water and then I put it in the sparkling water, and it's so good.
Yeah, I love doing that, adding bitters to it. You can kind of just make a little like mocktail. And I honestly noticed too that like sometimes if I eat, you know, if I go out and I eat pasta, it just like makes me feel bloated and kind of yuck, but the ACV really helps with that.
And yeah, from a digestive standpoint, we need an acidic environment in our stomach to digest, break down, and absorb food. So when you have those bitters or when you have the ACV, it's literally signaling to your stomach like food is coming, make more of those juices. It's making it more of an acidic environment to help break down, digest, absorb. And that's what's going to also help with preventing bloating and discomfort.
Yeah. Anything that we missed?
No. I mean, this is a lot of info that I share in a lot of my group program. So you're getting some really actionable things today. I would love to hear any feedback. So if people have follow-up questions, feel free to send me a message. But I think this stuff is really cool. I'm probably going to run my Take Back Your Health program again, where you can wear a monitor for 2 weeks and I give you personalized recommendations to figure out what's the best diet for you.
Love it. So many actionable takeaways today. So Nora, thank you. And I hope that if you're listening, something resonated with you. If it did, make sure you come over to social and let us know or leave a review and let us know how this episode helped you. We will see you in the next episode.
See you next week.